Hello, and welcome to the Time Wars Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast.
My name is John Mayo.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about one of the Time Wars novels by Simon Hawke. In this episode, I am joined by my sister for a spoiler-filled discussion of Book 6 of the Time Wars, the Kyber Connection. What's the correct pronunciation of that?
I think Kyber.
The Kyber Connection, because it's all set in Kyber Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for... There's two sets of these paperbacks. There's the one that was originally done, I think, by Ace back in the 80s and 90s. And then since then, the author's gotten them back, re-released them on Amazon. And on the re-release, this is the first of the books that doesn't have art on the cover. He's gone very minimalist and was able to knock the price down by a good couple of bucks by doing that. So the first five are, I think, $12.95 for the paperback. And at this point, it drops to, I want to say $9.95, maybe a little less, and a corresponding drop on the Kindle. But if you get the paperback, do the matchbook, it's still the 99, it's whatever. Anyways, and it's interesting that he chose kind of this novel to do that with, because there was a marked change in the nature of the narrative a little bit. Because it through the other books, we'd been getting, okay, we've got an adjustment, now we've got to, you know, raise the stakes, and we're now 6 books into that. So the stakes have gotten significantly high. I mean, at the end of the last book, the main villain was revealing he was not going to do 1, but 20 splits of the timeline that they narrowly averted.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of interesting where they've been going and how they've been progressing some stuff here.
Well, and all of the other books have been tied either to literary characters or to authors.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, this one is. There are characters from a story Rudyard Kipling wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But the character we spend more time with, in a sense, is Winston Churchill.
Yes.
And it's drawn from a work that he wrote after actually serving in this location and this war, the Boer War.
Well, it's Winston Churchill, the would-be author, not Winston Churchill, the massive historical figure that he was.
Well, it's him as the war correspondent, yeah, which is something he did in his youth. But it's him at the beginning of his life envisioning a different life for himself.
Well, and when we get to the part of the book where he's introduced, some interesting stuff happens there.
Very interesting.
Along the lines of who he is and isn't and stuff.
And how people respond to him based on what they know, based on
what they know and how they know it.
Yeah. I was going to say based on kind of their hobbies versus their sub-knowledge.
Yeah. The prologue of this features Sergeant Thomas Court, who pretty much lasts just the length of the prologue and whatnot. He's one of the guys sent back in the Time War to play on one side of a war. And as you were just telling me and reminding me before we started recording, these guys who are just the cannon fodder.
Yeah.
They don't know who's arguing about what and if their side won the skirmish or whatever. And
yeah, when they get back to the future, the only thing they will know is that they as an individual survived. They won't know what arbitration matter they had been sent back because of, and they won't know who won the arbitration matter.
Or what that meant for them to have won.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is he was basically saying how, you know, if his luck didn't run out at this point, you know, he was just going to get sent to another skirmish, another war, and sooner or later, I mean, the odds are stacked against him.
Yeah.
So the odds of people retiring from this line of work are fairly low.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. And for him to have died the way he died here in the prologue by encountering his opposite number from another timeline.
And they played that so well.
Yeah.
I mean, it started out with just the face beneath the turban was in shadow. But as the Ghazi turned toward him, Court gasped involuntarily. The moonlight revealed the dark skin of an Afridi tribesman, but the features were his own. And it was a callback to all those cosmetic surgeries in the previous books.
It was him, but changed to look appropriate for the region.
Yeah, and to be on the other side of the conflict. So to know, or to have that understanding of how can I be fighting on both sides of the same conflict. And then, you know, half convinced he was delirious, Court kept the rifle pointed at the apparition and said, "Who are you?" The Ghazi stared at him. "Thomas Court," he said, "Sergeant, U.S. Army Temporal Corps." "Yes, I'm Court, but how?" And somehow he suddenly knew that the man had not recognized him, but rather had answered his question. And just as suddenly, he realized the man was going to kill him.
Well, and you can just see that scene kind of playing out.
Yeah.
Where they both realize almost simultaneously, you're me and I'm you, and that can't be.
Yeah, well, in that moment when you realize that the man you thought had come to rescue you was there to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, those astronomical odds finally played out. Yeah. And not to skip ahead, but later when his body is found.
Let's not get to that just yet. But there's some interesting stuff that implies that I'm going to use the timeline that we've been following so far as our timeline, just for convenience. But it shows that our Thomas Court survived just longer enough.
Well, I was going to say, what we have revealed to us is that our Thomas Court had a brain or had intelligence.
Oh, yeah. And thought beyond just himself.
Yeah, and I really appreciated that.
Yeah. When we get to chapter one, the mission kickoff or whatever happened very differently.
I found it amusing. I was highlighting like crazy at that point.
Well, what got me was Forrester is meeting face to face with the general director of the Referee Corps for the first time ever.
Yes, yes. Well, and they've basically snuck in the head of the Referee Corps into Forrester's apartments. Kind of the, we don't want people to know he's here.
Mm-hmm. What I loved about this is as Vargas was grilling kind of Forrester about, you know, his first division and whatnot, who's his best team, tell me about these people. In the last book, we got very good physical descriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Here we essentially get pretty good psych profiles of these people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of my favorite lines was, how is it that the finest officer under your command is teamed with a man who has one of the worst records of offenses in the entire temporal corps, a man who in civilian life might well have been a convicted felon?
Well, in the response to that, I loved a Forrester saying, you know, I don't dispute that Lieutenant Delaney holds the record for the most reductions in grade of any soldier in the Temporal Corps, he continued. But that's only looking at it one way. He also holds the record for the most promotions for outstanding service in the field. And there, you know, some, he would go on to say there's some that are more public-facing friendly than Delaney.
Yes.
And the two, Lucas and Finn, work well together, even though they're very different people.
Yes. Yeah.
Again, some fun.
Well, and he says all the disciplinary offenses occurred in plus time.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the field, in minus time.
Well, and that Delaney's the type that would probably fare even worse in civilian life.
Yes.
So, good psych profile of him. Very interesting one on Cross, on how adaptable she is and, you know, what a unique person she is within the first division.
Yeah, well, and when he summed up Priest and Delaney, he said, if I want a man in the field calling the shots, I'll pick Priest. If I want someone at my back, I'll take Delaney. If I can have them both, I'll bring you results, as their record shows.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was just a great way to sum up those two as we've seen them for five books.
Yeah, yeah. What was interesting here is when Forrester starts to learn a little about the, or we at least learn a little bit more about what happened. There's a line that I highlighted of in recovering the bodies of temporal soldiers who had infiltrated into the British ranks, SNR, Search and Retrieval, found the body of one Sergeant Thomas Court. And I'm like, technically that's not true. They found two bodies of one Sergeant Thomas Court.
Yes, yes.
And I loved this bit because what happened is the court of our timeline had assumed a quote-unquote curious posture with the index finger of his right hand pressed against his temple where his implant would be, and the other hand pointing at the head of the dead tribesman. And Search and Retrieval is like, well, he's trying to tell us something. I don't know what this is. So they scan the other body for an implant, don't find anything, but it's like, something's going on here. So they take that body with them to the future, and the autopsy revealed an implant, but a different implant than the temporal core would use, or at least on a different frequency. And that all the way down to fingerprints, retinal patterns, everything, the two bodies were identical.
Yeah.
And so what that's telling us is this whole mission is based on Court being either at the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time, depending on your perspective. But the two courts meeting, the two courts dying, the court from our timeline lasting just enough longer to get into that position. And for the Search and Retrieval people to say, hey, what's going on here, and take both bodies.
Yeah.
If any of that hadn't happened or happened just enough differently to prevent that chain of events.
Our Search and Retrieval team got there before the other timelines. Search and Retrieval team.
Stuff at the end of the book had our Search and Retrieval retrieving their people too, because all of this was taking place
in our timeline.
In our timeline.
True.
So I thought, could the other team have gotten there first or whatnot? And I would say no, because they don't have necessarily a Search and Retrieval team.
Interesting.
And we'll get to some of that as we go.
Yeah, well, because they're crossing over.
But there was a lot of things that had to line up for our side to even be in the fight. Because if they hadn't had that, they wouldn't have necessarily been able to go back and prevent what turns out to be another timeline that is intersected into a confluence point where they're coming to our side trying to, you know, destroy the timeline to save their own.
Well, and they do have a reason to be mad at us, as we find out.
When we get to that, that's a lot of fun and good motivation as to, well, I don't think we'll be able to talk this one out.
I like that you describe it as fun.
I do kind of want to go in the flow of the story.
I agree, but I find it hilarious you're describing that as fun.
Yeah. In chapter 3 is where we get both Winston Churchill and Gunga Din as kind of the two main historical slash quasi-literary figures. We have the three soldiers.
Yeah.
But if you haven't read the one book they're from Kipling, which I would argue a lot of us have not.
I tried, and I will give Kipling credit. He did an excellent job of writing drunk British phonetically, which made it perfectly confusing to me. Which I think if I encountered a drunk Brit, they would be perfectly confusing to me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the Time War series would be a very interesting kind of a backbone for an English literature course.
Yes.
As let's go with a fun sci-fi read, talk about that. But as we're hitting Robin Hood, the Scarlet Pimpernel, and stuff like that, let's dive into those areas. And I think there's also a philosophy component, certainly in this book, what's right, what's wrong, and just from a thought experiment. So from a almost cross-disciplinary thing, I think this series of novels, in terms of history, literature, speculative science, and thought exercises and stuff, there's so much material to go in on, and in particularly in this book, but also in some of the others. Of, well, if you do a split and you undo it and they wipe out, I mean, did you just do genocide?
Yeah.
So that's part of what I love about this series is it's not trying to be grandiose or full of itself, but there's a lot of fun ideas to toy with and digest. There's something to chew on.
There's a lot to think about here. Yeah. Definitely.
What I found a lot of fun, and I was curious where this character was going to go. When we got to chapter 4 and we get Sheriff Khan, and that's S-H-A-R-I-F, not like it's a police sheriff, just in case anyone was thinking, you know, Khan from Trek had decided to go into law enforcement. No, not the case. We'd gotten a little bit on this guy, how he's a warlord, gone up into power and stuff. Okay, he's relevant, but maybe he's just one of these historical figures.
No.
Nope, not his real name. He was last known as Rhys Hunter, not his real name. He was known as Barry Martingale, whom we'd met last book. And what I got was a little later. Nope, not his real name.
Mm-hmm.
He's Agent Phoenix of the TIA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's a guy in the span of, because we get his real name at the end of the book, in the span of one novel goes through four names.
Yeah.
And as much as I would like to track where these characters show up and whatnot in these novels, this makes that a little difficult.
Yeah.
Because if I'm not careful, I start mixing this Rhys with the real Rhys.
Yeah.
And you go with Martingale. I mean, it's fun. It makes sense. A little confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to see the arc for the character parallel what happened with Cross.
Mm-hmm.
Encounter the person in the field. At first, they're on the opposite side. You wind up encountering them on another mission. Actually, I don't even think they do encounter him on the mission. They encounter him after the fact and realize he'd been in there. Because I don't think their paths directly cross in this book. But at the end of it, he joins the team.
I think they encounter him at the very end.
They certainly in the epilogue, they encounter him. But I'm not sure if in the past, I'd have to, as we go through this, I'm trying to remember. Again, so much happens in so many characters to keep track of.
Yeah.
And when, you know, in most of the book, he's referred to as Phoenix.
Yes. Well, I loved at one point where, and I think it was Darkness talking to him, was saying, you're an intelligence agent. Go out and gather some intelligence. And try displaying some occasion. Use your initiative.
We got a lot more of Darkness in this novel, and you know, as I'm going through these and stuff, I'm thinking again, you know, just as a mental exercise, it'd be fun. Who would I cast as these characters? Keeping in mind, these novels came out essentially, you know, what, 25, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who would have been cast then are now the wrong age to cast now, and the people you would cast now would have been the wrong age then.
I can think of one person who I think would have been good then and now, but who are you thinking?
Well, I was thinking for Dr. Darkness, who I would cast right now.
Yeah.
Brent Spiner. He's got that kind of, I almost want to say the go away kid, you bother me kind of. Mm-hmm. Just the, he could play the absent-minded, arrogant, and somewhat antisocial scientist.
See, I'm thinking both then and now for Darkness, I would cast John Larroquette.
Certainly, he's another possibility. He was one I was kind of debating for Forrester.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because now with the age, I can see him for Forrester. But I was just saying, because back then he had Night Court under his belt.
Oh, yeah, and Larroquette's a terrific kind of a guy. And he's also one that can really deliver the show some intelligence, kind of.
Yeah.
The biting, and not that he's necessarily trying to be rude, it's just that's the way he is kind of character.
Yeah.
You need somebody who's a likable, unlikable character.
Yes, which is hard.
It's a fine line.
Yeah.
It's
hard to act and it's hard to write.
Yeah. Well, and to have somebody who, part of the shtick of Dr. Darkness is when he shows up in the past to these other characters, he's rooted in his spot. He can't walk around.
Yes.
So somebody who can kind of play with that and have fun would be good.
Mm-hmm.
And the character was used quite a bit in this.
More than I expected.
But also had a little bit of a softer side when he encountered Gunga Din.
Yes.
It's like, how did you get here kind of a thing.
Yes, yes.
And again, Larroquette or Spiner would be interesting for that.
Yeah. In chapter 4 was when Lucas, I think, was talking to Cross, and that was when he realized.
Before we get to that, I had one other thing on Phoenix. He had to stage a convenient car accident for Captain Hunter to die and no trace of the body, just to kind of close off the loop and free himself up to go back to his, I guess, day job as a time you know, intelligence agency officer or whatever.
It's so tough trying to conceal your whereabouts.
Well, particularly when you've got four or five identities to do it with.
It's so tough.
When we got to the reveal, what I loved was Andre. She's talking with Lucas, and I know, she said, you've been preoccupied throughout the entire journey. It's this Churchill fellow, isn't it? You keep staring at him. This Churchill fellow? Lucas replied, or said. And she's like, yeah, what's so special about him? Good Christ, you really don't know? Should I? Well, actually, you'd be about the only one I could think of in the service who'd have a good excuse. He's not part of your history. You went straight from the 12th century to the 27th century. That leaves a hell of a gap. You still ought to know about him, though, and I find that puzzling. And it comes out that he was not in the implant knowledge.
Yeah, not in the sub-knowledge or in the mission program knowledge.
And they get into this big discussion about how, you know, he can't not have been there. And the only thing they could think of was a temporal disruption, that the implant programming they had was from a timeline in which he wasn't a historical figure and therefore could not have been in there.
Yeah, whatever happened that caused Churchill to be wiped from history must have happened after I read about him.
Because apparently Lucas was a history buff.
And he liked to read books, which weren't dependent on the implant knowledge.
That's one of the things, if I were to take this either as a comic book series, a movie series, TV series, whatever, I would add a few things, not necessarily as even scenes, but as aspects of scenes. We should have seen Lucas reading or with books or showing some kind of, oh, there's a bookstore there as we're in ancient, you know, London or whatever. Not ancient, but you know what I mean. Historical London. Vintage London. Something to show he has that interest, to kind of set this up, just like his chess stuff, last book, and a few other things.
Yeah.
And there's stuff that, for an author, there's no way he can necessarily project, geez, I'm doing who knows how many books, turned out to be 12, who knows what he expected it to be, to plant the seeds of everything to foreshadow them in previous books. I mean, it's unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got 12 novels to work with, you can take some of that and plant it back earlier and do a little foreshadowing and subtly.
Yeah.
You know? And just to discover, did Lucas start reading about history in general or the places he'd been or what?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I mean, did he start reading about the Three Musketeers after he met them because he wanted to know more about what happened to them? You know, how did that play out? And I like books that are stories that have that additional depth, that if you dive a little beneath the surface, you have these, how did this work for that character?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it makes them feel more real.
Yes.
But the whole discussion they had on, I mean, Lucas pretty much convinces himself he's going to wind up getting Churchill killed.
Yes.
Because he knows about him. Nobody else does. They've separated from Finn, although they started the mission together. Does Finn know about Churchill? Does he not? All this kind of stuff. And it goes to the Zen physics of the series.
Yeah.
Which is part of what I love about it. I mean, to me, the thought exercises around time travel, and if you go on the theory that the universe wants to have a semblance of, I don't say order, because there's certainly entropy and all of that, but of predictability, of rules of physics that apply beyond just the obvious gravity. That's to say gravity's obvious. You could go back a few thousand years and they'd be, well, you know, wouldn't have even conceived of it. But you get the idea. How would time work that way if you were to do something, you know, unnatural? And it would be like explaining to somebody, well, if I dropped a watermelon from, you know, a mile up, you go far enough back, well, how would you get the watermelon a mile up? How would you, you know, and you couldn't have the discussion. But then once you could say, okay, I can do that. Now, if you've gotten past the, well, you can't time travel, okay, but assuming I could, how would a disruption work? How would all this stuff? Here's a guy who's basically, the only way he could think of that they wouldn't have had the knowledge is a split had occurred and they were on kind of the wrong side of it or something.
Mm-hmm. The only way he could conceive of that Winston Churchill was not in the historical record as prime minister was that he was never prime minister.
Yes.
For the fact to not be known, it could not have been fact. He did not conceive of fake news.
And it's interesting what winds up happening later.
It is. It is.
And, you know, it's one of those things, as I was driving home from work the other night, I was thinking about, but what about? And the thought that kind of popped into my mind around that was, there's a difference between an omniscient narrator and an omniscient reader. The author and the narrator knows everything that's going on. We do not.
Yeah.
So it comes down to, are things fair play storytelling or not? And if a character says, well, the only way this could have happened would have been thus and so, you take that as fact when it is really that character's opinion of fact.
Yes. The only way I can conceive of.
Yes.
Is what the statement means. But it is the way people speak.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's fair writing.
Yes.
Now, if it was in the omniscient narrator voice of, and this is what happened.
Yes.
That, to me, starts to be a little not fair play. And we got some of that in the Pimpernel plot when Finn materializes, but it turns out he'd been in a fugue state for a bit.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to give a little bit of grace, but because presumably we were trying to see that through Finn's perspective.
Well, and like I said, there was something, when we talked about that book, there was just something strange to me about the way he arrived and they seemed to be stalling for time instead of rushing him to where I thought they were rushing him to.
Well, I believe that was the book where they give us the backstory of how he had at one point materialized in, stepped on like a rabbit right as he did it. And he's been a little jumpy on the clock in point ever since.
He almost stepped on a rabbit in Robin Hood.
Which was I thought it was the Pimpernel plot where he was talking about how it sounded like a baby. He thought he'd killed some, you know.
Yeah, no, that was in the in Robin Hood's Sherwood Forest.
All right, I'm misremembering that. I could have sworn that was in the Pimpernel plot. Anyways.
I can make you go back and look.
We'll check after we record. You might be right. Either way, that's the sort of thing that if you do, you coach the actors kind of a thing on that and have it play. And it's not something that's always got to be there, but if you establish it is, it's got to be a personality trait.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lucas is the thinking type, so he kind of almost psychs himself out to a degree.
Yeah, one of the things we didn't mention, but I do want to go back for, because I think it will come up later, when they were talking about Andre and kind of pitching how she fits into the team despite being a displaced person, he said the three of them together function as a well-integrated whole.
Yes.
And I thought that was just a really good description. And this was a mission where the three of them arrived together.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to kind of be split up and go in different directions. But they did start together and arrive together, which I liked.
Yes, and it made sense why they would split, because they had to kind of position themselves to cover more ground.
Yes, they had a lot of searching to do.
They went in not knowing, I mean, something's important about this time, but what?
Yeah, we have no idea what's going on. We don't know why there were two of this guy here. We got to figure out what the heck is going on here and why.
And again, the main theory is a temporal split at this point, so protect the key historical figures.
Yeah.
Now, in Chapter 5, we're dealing more with Phoenix, or Martingale, and stuff, and his team of Python, Zebra, Mustang, Fox, Sable, all of which are these agents and such, none of which, other than Phoenix, I think, make it out of the book alive.
I think you're right.
Not a healthy profession to be in.
It's not a good world in which to be an animal.
Mm-hmm. We get to Chapter 6, and at this point, they've almost, I don't say the hopelessness of the situation, of particularly for Court or whatnot, but there's references to this Khyber Pass being like a death trap for soldiers.
Yes.
How at one point, one group was basically going to do kind of the reenactment of the 300 Spartans of just hold this ground and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that's going on, Lucas and Andre have Winston Churchill to keep alive because he seems important. And we hit what I considered a major turning point in the story.
Sayyid Akbar?
No. Let me read the paragraph. In the white heat of adrenaline-charged clarity, he saw it all. He made a running dive for Churchill. The Ghazi fired. The 50-caliber ball slammed into Lucas's chest, plowing through the thorax and tearing everything in its path. Andre fired the revolver Hugo had given her, shooting the Ghazi right between the eyes. Lucas Priest
died. It was beyond tragic. Yeah.
So, at this point, he's been able to talk to Andre of, you know, Churchill's important and whatnot, realizes that what he had done was warn somebody else who dived out of the way, putting Winston in the line of fire. His fault. He's got to make it right. He's willing to die for that. And it was very much a turning point.
Well, and Andre realizes that Churchill must be massively important if Lucas would die for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Andre's already gone through quite a bit. This is the second kind of time-traveling mentor or whatever she's had after Reese to die.
Yeah.
What was interesting was after he's been buried, Din, Gunga Din, thought he saw somebody standing over the grave. Perhaps, thought Din, it was only his imagination, or perhaps it was a portent. He shut his eyes and muttered a quick prayer to Shiva. He thought he had seen a tall, dark figure wearing a long robe that billowed in the wind. And I'm like, ooh, well, that sent something up. And of course, we come back to that a little later. But then we get Sayyid Akbar, who again has been set up a few times in the book already.
Well, we have one throwaway comment that I was not positive how to take. I mean, it comes back later. But even with how it comes back later, I wasn't positive how to take. Because he tells Sadula, mm-hmm. "You're a fool, Sadula," Sayyid Akbar said. "You have already lost this battle once before, and now you shall lose it again.
Oh,
I've
yeah.
given you another chance, and you are wasting it."
What we find out about Sadula later kind of gives some clarity on that. What confused me when we first saw Sayyid Akbar in a previous chapter was there was a, you know, Sadula turns around and he had vanished.
Yes.
And we're only, you know, the second book with the warp discs.
Yes.
Where now people have personal time travel devices on them versus the chronoplate.
Mm-hmm.
So before, we usually had the team kind of clock in and just go through the mission and get picked up later. Now they've got a bit more freedom, as does this Sayyid, who it turns out is Nikolai Drakov.
Yeah, he had to come back.
And we also get a comment here of, there's no telling how long this confluence will remain stable. There's no margin for error, Drakov. So he's working with others, and this is kind of the first clear thing about the confluence, which later gets explained, of two timelines that were in parallel, not a split, but a separate timeline. They had gotten to the point where they're close enough together that there's essentially overlap, and you could cross from one to the other.
Yeah.
And this whole kind of weakness in the time-space fabric has been in, you know, tons of other stories where you kind of walk down the wrong street and crossed over into another reality.
Yeah.
And it was well used here. It made sense, particularly when, again, the other timeline decides, this is bad for us. We're going to make this stop by disrupting your timeline, causing it to kind of go out of phase with ours, if you will. Now, what's interesting is Drakov's around on the side of the non-British, which is this group again. I'm horrible with my Middle Eastern history.
Is he with the Ghazis, the Afridi?
The Ghazis, I think.
The Ghazis.
But he's there, and we've already set up Phoenix as Sharif Khan, mm-hmm. who is going to be working with Sayyid Akbar.
Yeah, oops.
And Phoenix is there realizing, oh crap, this is the guy who I just betrayed last novel. He's not thinking it that way, but that's what I'm translating it as.
Yeah, sure he is. That's a great paraphrase.
Fortunately, in this time and place, a lot of people don't need to meet, you know, kind of eye to eye. You can do the bowing and
keep your head down, your turban low.
Yeah. But slowly, Phoenix raised his head, meeting Dracoff's gaze. Dracoff's eyes widened for a moment, then he gave a faint ghost of a smile. And then shortly thereafter, he turned and nodded to his guards, moving with lightning speed to the guards, plunged their long knives into Fox and Sable. The agents never had a chance to cry out. So out of the five other guys he had, Phoenix just lost two of them pretty quickly. The other three he'd left back at his base or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's one of those that, given how in the previous novels they'd always been disguising themselves.
Yes.
And this is probably one of the first TIA agents that was not a master of disguise, like Mongoose, Cobra.
That's very true.
And it really would have benefited him to have studied that up a little bit.
But, you know, he wasn't expecting to encounter a moody 93-year-old.
True, true. But he looks young for his age, Dracoff.
That's very true.
It's one of those things, though, that had he not abandoned the Reese Hunter identity but embraced it.
Yes.
And changed his features, maybe the doctors might have done that accidentally. Finn said he was Reese. This is what Reese looks like. Let's fix the guy up from his third-degree burns or whatever.
That's very true.
Because he's explaining at the beginning that, you know, if they hadn't saved me, I'd have died. I'm happy not to be dead. But having this other identity kind of complicated matters.
Yeah.
At this point, we've got Finn off with the whichever battalion or whatever, the Lancers and stuff. Lucas and Andre posing as a priest, medic, and his nurse. We've got Phoenix off on one other contingent, Dracoff off on another contingent. We've got three or four or five different kind of plot lines we're following on this.
Lucas just died, so you're doesn't right. that mean Finn got detailed to take her to safety?
Even if he did, at one point they were off separate. My point is, there are a lot of plot threads to follow, and some of them kind of dovetail and split off.
Yeah.
What was interesting, though, is a couple of pages later, actually a page later, they're encountering, they were field gray instead of black, and the insignias were different, unlike any they had ever seen before. He wore a patch over one eye, and in his right hand held a laser at his side. This is when they encounter the other Lucas, and it's gray versus black, different insignia, stuff like that. The twin priest smiled. It's the uniform of a captain in the Special Operations Group of the United States Temporal Army. They have a Special Operations Group, not a first branch, or first division.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do the Time Wars, so they don't have search and retrieval and the referee group and all of that stuff as such.
Yeah.
In this other timeline. There's a lot that we get.
Well, and Dracoff gave us why the other timeline wants to go to war with us.
Yes. Before we got that, we got how Dracoff got looped in with them.
Yeah, poor Dracoff.
It was interesting because after the last book, Benedetto and him had clocked out to the 27th century.
Or so they thought.
Well, because nobody would think to look for us there. They're hunting the past. Okay. Reasonable plan. But they clocked forward into a different timeline. And what that means is by the end of the last book, whatever caused the confluence events or whatever had happened.
Yeah.
And it's still unclear to me what caused that.
Yeah.
But it was close enough that at first they didn't realize it, but different enough that they made mistakes resulting in their apprehension. And as they were exhaustively debriefed, the other side was basically trying to get information on the timeline. Because, of course, they don't usually have people kind of clocking in or whatnot, so they knew it was a problem.
The other timeline had a mystery they were trying to resolve.
Oh, yeah, and I think that's best set up by the quote, "What do you think happens when somebody sets off a warp grenade?" said Dracoff. "Such as when Lucas Priest exploded one in 19th century Ritania to break out of Zenda Castle," which of course hurt Lucas quite a bit. And basically what they realize, our side realizes, but the other side had had plenty of empirical evidence on, it shunted the stuff off into this other timeline, thereby kind of linking the two. So this other timeline, which had gone more into space, less into time travel and such, they were having a lot of places get nuked for no reason with no warning. And they're like, what is going on?
Hundreds of thousands of deaths.
Yeah. Because basically when you tie one of these things into one of the Einstein-Rosen generator things or whatever, what seems like an insignificant escalation of power or whatever apparently changes where it lands quite a bit.
Yeah.
And it was one of those, they'd had this Holocaust on the other side, and they're like, you've declared war on us.
The other side has been suffering nuclear war attacks for who knows how long.
It's unclear how long, and part of that is because some of these warp grenades were set off in the past and landed in the future.
Yeah, and they've definitely been on the receiving end of multiple attacks.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a, you can't say, I'm sorry, when hundreds of thousands of people are dead across multiple locations in the other timeline.
Well, in the other timeline acknowledged that even if, I mean, if they knew, they wouldn't have done it.
Yes.
But they'd done it nonetheless. The people are still dead.
Yeah.
It set up a very clear attack, and it was, how was it phrased? Each attack was a nuclear strike, and we've now learned that each attack came from your timeline through an artificially created warp in time-space, warp grenades. And Delaney's like, what have we done? And the special operations group was brought together based on information obtained from Nikolai Drakov. Now, I didn't know if that meant they recruited particular people he had encountered, such as Lucas Priest, or how some of that happened.
It sounded like something to that effect, because Priest was saying he hadn't been in the military until this came up.
I thought he'd been in, but had been retired and pulled back.
Yeah, something to that, yeah.
So I think what happened was there were some time wars, but they stopped at a reasonable point. That timeline's unclear to me, because if they had not been traveling in time for the time wars, they would not have had a referee go rogue, causing Lucas to, and Finn, or at least Lucas, encounter Andre in the past, for her to then encounter Reese, get pulled forward to the 17th century, and then pulled forward to the 27th, to where she's around and able to marry Lucas in this alternate timeline, which clearly they did.
But it sounds like the alternate timeline had no Delaney.
Right, so he could have been killed before. It's
yeah.
Or, well, not that they had no did they say they had no Delaney, or just that they hadn't met, Lucas hadn't met Delaney?
I thought they had said there was no Delaney.
I don't recall. The quote I'm seeing that I highlighted didn't specify that. I'd have to go back and reread part of it. It's a little unclear, again, how the other timeline kind of shaped up.
Yeah.
There's some strong similarities. Do they report to a forest or do they not?
That
kind of a deal. But as time goes on, some of these parallels kind of diverge a bit. It really set up a, because, I mean, to me, in a time travel story where you set up your fixing adjustments, the minute you have a split, you've got two sides equally vested in maintaining their history.
Yes.
So a team against mirror image of team sort of a thing was somewhat inevitable.
Yes.
For it to happen from a different timeline, because a comment was made, and I'm not sure if I highlighted it or not, that they know it was a different timeline, not a split, because there are other differences in the past. In other words, it's not just like one event, but their history was in sync until then.
Yeah.
There were other things that were different, and there was a mention of the laws of physics even being a little different.
Yes, yes. Well, and I mean, I found it interesting that their solution to preserving both timelines was interfere with your history in order to protect our own.
Yeah, it was just the quote I was going to go to. They have to increase the instability in your timeline, even to the point of bringing a time split if necessary, in order to maintain our temporal integrity.
Yeah.
You know, for us to survive, you can't, almost.
You can't survive as you are.
Yeah.
You have to be more divergent from us.
There was also mentioned at this point that this Lucas was married to Andre, and they're not the same people.
This Lucas had the eye patch, seemed to have the artificial eye and the headache problem, which is why I realized our Lucas wasn't wearing the eye patch, I had gotten over the headache problem.
I thought when our Lucas was introduced, he still had the eye patch. The headache problem seemed to be gone. I thought this one had the... He had the eye... Okay, so you're saying having the eye patch implies the false eye, which is interesting because that implies that alternate Lucas went through some variation of the Zenda Vendetta.
Our Lucas. He was slender and fit, the perfect incarnation of an officer and a gentleman. His left eye was natural, his right bionic, though not even the closest physical inspection would have revealed the difference.
Yeah, you're right. So at that point, he's ditched the eye patch, he's gotten used to it. There was also a mention of the hundreds of missions they'd done. So time has elapsed. Let me rephrase that. They've aged.
Well, and going back to Drakov is 93. When we first met Drakov, he was 80.
Mm-hmm. Well, but some of that was also during the Zenda Vendetta when he went to go train.
Some of it was then. Some of it was just in the last book. He seemed to...
I was thinking the Nautilus Sanction is when he'd gone to train. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
There was some definite interesting stuff here. What I also liked was at this point... Our Lucas Priest has died. He was the only one in the previous book to get the patch or whatever.
Yes.
That had the symbiotracers that Dr. Darkness used.
And Darkness was very bitter about that.
But it goes back to what Gunga Din saw, was Darkness kind of doing a quick visit. It's like, oh. Now, what was interesting is he was visible for that, mm-hmm. for Gunga Din. Whereas he should have shown up, been invisible.
True.
And not have been seen. So that was curious. But the frustration he's got is like, I can't follow him. I don't have tracers now. Was fun. And then we get a fair bit of explanation or exposition between Darkness and Phoenix, where they're both kind of getting each other a little up to speed and stuff. And Darkness is pointing out, yeah, I invented the warp grenade. This is kind of all on me. Oops.
I love Darkness's line. Besides, I can only be in two places at the same time.
Yeah. What I loved, though, was Phoenix, after getting all the stuff from Darkness's... You mean it's sort of like a time stream split in reverse.
Mm.
And it's like, that's a very interesting way of... You know, you've got something where an event splits the two timelines. Now you've got two that are touching and something that would merge them to kind of stabilize.
Yeah.
And how disruptive that would be. And again, it's a reversal of a time stream split. That sort of escalation of things... I like how it's not just, well, let's do another adjustment.
Yes.
There's risks with the continual raising of the stakes, but there's some fun to be had with it.
Well, and in keeping with the, we understand the adjustment aspect. They do try to keep Churchill alive throughout the mm-hmm. book. So there is that common ground that you know what to expect aspect.
Now, in chapter 10... They establish here that Lucas was a collector of old history books, specializing in 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, which is most of where we've seen him go adventuring, so okay, makes sense. Although he spent time in ancient Rome and didn't seem to be go reading up on that.
True.
I guess it's where he's been doing his adjustments and stuff. But there's also a comment that only a small group of dedicated scholars and antiquarians, gosh, I can't read. Read books anymore. Everyone else uses information retrieval systems.
Yeah.
And that by not having stuff in the sub-knowledge, and just, it also goes back to how reliant they've been on it, which is a recurring theme in the books. You've kind of got this background thing that when you hear somebody's name, you just kind of know things about them that you didn't know.
Yeah.
Of course, that was set up as early as the Ivanhoe Gambit, when they get sent off on the mission and the code word is the name of the author, and that suddenly floods them with knowledge. But again, it's a little bit of a shame that Lucas's collecting of history books and stuff wasn't set up a little in some of the other novels.
Yeah.
Even if it had just been in the Nautilus Sanction when he's walking around the library, it's like, oh, I've read this. Ooh, that one I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
Something. Not a big deal, but it would have helped. Wouldn't have hurt, let's put it that way. But when we get to the point of the defeat of the Atira Expeditionary Force, it could end British control of the frontier and drastically alter the picture of this part of the world. And that assassinating Winston Churchill in the same scenario would not only further disrupt history in this time period, but would disrupt it in the earliest 20th century, leading not to one but two time stream splits. I got a little confused by that. I get that at this point in time, if this expeditionary force fails and British loses control of that region, boom, time stream split, major change. But that other split timeline, that's where you would have had the change in the 20th century, etc., with Winston Churchill not being there. I don't get why you'd get a second split in the 20th century from the events of this one change back here.
I thought they were saying that you would have the instant change of losing and changing the development of that part of the world right then. And you would have the change to the path of Winston Churchill's life. And so 10, 20 years down the road, he wouldn't be prime minister.
I agree with that. My point is, you're at this one crossroad and stuff. You've got how history went before, so they've got their baseline.
Mm-hmm.
You're now saying if things happen and it splits, you've created the branch.
Mm-hmm.
In that second branch, history is dictated by the British losing control of the frontier, yada, yada, yada. Okay? In that timeline, it might not even matter if Winston Churchill was around because of other events. And even if it did, and he's not, that's the timeline that would just have... The only course it could go on is without Winston Churchill if he's dead. Oh, I guess what it's saying is there's the branch it would do if they just lost control.
But he survives.
But he survives. Right. But if he didn't, that doesn't necessarily translate until later.
If he survives, there's still Hitler. So then you've got the he survives, we have Hitler, but we have no Prime Minister Churchill.
I guess I'm seeing it as this event, there would be the one branch of if they lose control...
Right.
Of the region. And if he dies, that's another split as to which happens first. Okay. This is where you've got to almost diagram it out.
Right.
And it's confusing, but I love this kind of stuff. It's something to chew on and just try to, what makes logical sense given what we kind of know and can envision.
Yeah. But no, this wasn't a death of Churchill.
One of the other comments I highlighted was, and I think it was Dracoff who was doing this, was that one of the things he tried to impress on the soldiers from the alternate timeline. Their plan had to be multi-leveled one with fallback positions. The commandos had never failed in a historical adjustment, and these three were the best of the lot.
Yeah.
Dracoff knows what he's going up against.
Yeah.
Because he's already lost to them once. We also get where Sedula is basically told by Dracoff, yeah, just go up there and... you'll fall in line. So he goes up this stairs to the top of the tower, and he sees himself. Knowing nothing of Zen physics, he did not understand that he, who had been brought from the alternate timeline where he had already lost this holy war, now confronted his own twin in this timeline, whose place he had taken. He only saw himself staked out, naked on the floor, dying the death of a thousand cuts.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got somebody that you think is got magical powers, and he's already, you know, tormenting you or whatever. It's like, if you don't fall in line, this is your fate. Very creepy, and again, good use of the warp discs to kind of bounce in, bounce out. Dracoff was... it was interesting having him as part of the opposing timeline forces, but not as necessarily of part of them. And the three soldiers that we've been kind of following throughout that had been part of the expeditionary force that worked a little with Finn, a little with Lucas and Andre and stuff, and was trying to save those two when they'd gotten captured. Actually, Finn and Andre when they'd gotten captured by the other side. There's a lot of back and forth, and, you know, these guys are... and we've had this before. Most books have locals that are kind of pressed into service to help out. Not that they know the full picture in most cases, but just the other side. I mean, they're justified kind of sort of in why they're doing what they're doing, but maybe not to the extent of disrupting our timeline. Again, just a ton of stuff to be thinking about and dealing with. I found it fascinating and a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it pretty much ends on a note of we've dealt with this skirmish. We think we've stabilized this point of confluence, but this isn't over.
No.
And it results in a complete overhaul of the referee corps, the time intelligence agency, the first division, everything. As there's a call off of the time wars of their own, because now the time wars are against this other side.
Well, I mean, among the many things I found interesting, they kept Churchill alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was Andre at one point when Churchill had said, you know, I want to put something in my dispatches about you. And she said, you know, I don't want to be famous when I return home.
Yeah, please don't. I'd like to have my privacy when I get home.
Yeah. And then later they realize Finn may have deserted from one of the other units to join them.
Yeah, Finn basically had to tell these three soldier guys that he was under an assumed name because he'd been a deserter, there'd be problems, etc. He's trying to redeem himself or whatever.
Yeah.
To where if somebody says, well, there's no Finn Delaney in our army.
Yeah.
There was kind of an out.
Yeah.
The covering of their tracks, I thought, was well done.
Yeah, it was interesting.
This is also in the epilogue where the TIA has gone away, and the phrase is, now that the TIA has gone Army, we've dispensed with code names, and Agent Phoenix is now plain Colonel Creed Steiger.
Yes.
And of course, Andre's, oh, that's who Phoenix was.
Yes.
Because it had been used by Darkness before he blipped out, and she's like, who's Phoenix? I think Darkness often leaves people with more questions than answers.
Yes.
But to have Barry Martingale / Reed Hunter / Phoenix / Creed Steiger, again, four aliases in one book, it was a bit much, but it worked. This was one where we've gotten to a different part of the world because it's taking place in the Afghanistan area. The timeline's a little later than we've been before, but not by much. And the threat, again, was a reasonable kind of escalation.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of kind of the reversal of a split. There was a lot of fun here, and I felt, unlike the last book where the characters were almost along for the ride, they were much more active here. And when we got to the point where, and I didn't highlight it and I should have, it turns out that the other side had infiltrated the people who do the implant programming.
Yeah.
And edited Winston Churchill and others out because they were targets.
Yeah.
And that explained how Andre didn't know about them.
Yeah.
And it proved what a smart plan that was, because that had robbed the first division of Lucas Priest.
Yeah.
If they hadn't done that, events would have happened differently, and Winston probably would not have died, or would not have been at the risk of dying, and Lucas would not have died as a result of yada yada. You know what I mean?
Yeah. When I read some of what Winston Churchill wrote, and the real story is fascinating in terms of he was genuinely in the military service. He was in a minimal combat area from what I was reading. And he knew that over by the Khyber Pass and Malakand, there was a lot more action happening. And he was able to take 6 weeks leave from his unit. So he asked for it. And he volunteered, as this says, to go to the heavy action area on condition that while he was doing that, he could write war dispatches for the newspapers back in London. And, I mean, just to think that somebody would volunteer for the place where the most casualties were. And one of the things that he wrote about, I want to say it was Malakand, which was the one where they were saying that the base camp was in the bottom of a bowl and the enemy had just ringed the rim of this bowl-like.
Canyon or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. He said, you know, it's this environment that you can't imagine why anyone would think this is where we should put our camp. Originally, it was intended to be a temporary 2-week camp, and 2 years later, we were still trying to defend it. And it was just canvas tents and a few mud huts. But fear not, the senior officers had found an area to set up a polo field.
What I liked is there was an an author's note at the end where Simon Hawke is basically saying that the historical events here kind of actually happened other than the time travel and the obvious embellishments.
Yeah.
But that he took some liberties with the order of events in the exact timeline just to kind of make it fit his story.
Yeah.
And I like it when authors kind of give you some clues as to, if you're curious about this, it's a real world thing. You can learn more about it. I had to make some edits to fit the story, but this is kind of fake or whatever, you know, and
yeah,
and give you a little bit more if you want to dive deeper where to go. And there are a couple of comic book authors who do the same thing. Matt Hawkins is one of them, where he'll have a Think Tank was a series he would do with a kind of a super genius scientist that had been, I don't want to say enslaved by the U.S. military, but, you know, was being used. And all the different, you know, drones and different technologies the guy was doing, there'd be a couple of text pages at the end of, you know, this seems like a logical extension of this research being done here with a link, and this mm-hmm. is already sort of an action, but I extended it this way, so here. This sort of a threat is actually a real threat if you read this, you know. And just kind of sharing his notes.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that at the end of this.
Yeah, he references, The Soldiers 3 mm-hmm. by Rudyard Kipling. And then I read just a small portion of the story of the Malakand Field Force, an episode of the Frontier War by mm-hmm. Winston Churchill. Not going to say it's cheery reading.
Yeah, it's also interesting how he pulled one or two stories he'd heard and anecdotes or whatever. It's like, this is too good to pass up. I've got to put this in. They're like bit parts or whatever, but it adds color. It adds a sense of realism is not necessarily the right word, because some of these are a little larger than life, even if they have happened.
Yeah.
But this being the turning point from they're just fixing things in the past to there is now an entire timeline out to get them.
Yes.
With equal but not identical technology, and maybe superior technology in some respects. And that their mandate has been extended to not only fixing adjustments and a kind of safeguarding the confluence points, but to potentially going to the other timeline and waging war, you know, altering their timeline and such. So it certainly opens a ton of possibilities as to where they go with the series and whatnot. And again, a major personnel change with Steiger coming in and place of Lucas.
Yes.
And the question is, does Finn take over the unit? Does he not? How does that all play out?
Yeah.
Because while Phoenix Steiger was in this book, he was operating essentially on the other side of the war. And it was interesting because when he and his agents go back, one of them is like, well, we know there's an adjustment team here. How do we not accidentally target them? It's like, well, you can't.
Yeah.
That is a risk. That was a known risk of putting us over here and them over there.
You know, one of the things that neither of us thought to highlight or bring up is one of the many traumas that Andre goes through. And that is in the final conflict when they're saving Churchill. And she finally finds up on the hillside the people who are lobbing the weapons in at Churchill. And she's got her laser out and she's taken out the people on the hillside, and someone comes up to kill her, and they're at a standoff, basically having a problem firing on one another.
Oh, right. I forgot about, you're right. Again, pivotal moment, because she's there and it turns out it's the other Lucas doing this. And yeah. She can't shoot him because he looks like Lucas. He can't shoot her because it looks like his
wife.
Presumably dead wife.
Yeah.
But then he gets stabbed from behind.
Yeah.
Which was good, because that was the only way I think Finn would have been able to stab him.
Yes. Yes.
And, I mean, talk about a scene that, again, if this was in the movies, would give the actors so much to work with.
Yeah.
You know, it's... There's an aspect of this story that's much more emotionally charged in some respects than a lot of the others. I would say the other one that was like it would be the Zenda Vendetta, where you've got Forrester's son and some aspects of that.
Yeah,
but for the main three of Lucas, Finn, and Andre, this is the book that's kind of the juiciest to work with.
There was a part of me that was wondering, would the other priest survive and take our priest's place? I mean, what was going to happen? How are we going to move forward without Lucas Priest?
Mm-hmm.
And
very interesting question.
Yeah. And I mean, poor Finn having to kill him. Poor Andre almost having to kill him and having to witness it.
Watching him die twice.
Yeah.
He's the second character to die twice. Now, the other guy did it simultaneously with Court at the beginning.
Well, and you didn't even comment on somebody got their throat cut. One of the soldiers, three, cut a throat in The Great Escape from the Cell. You totally let that slide by.
I did. I guess last book was the one book we've not had that, but it's back. I guess for me, this one just had so much more to chew on. With the revelation that the warp grenades were bombing this other timeline, the whole existence of the other timeline, the alternate priest, the sub-knowledge not being there, how do things play out?
I will admit, I didn't care for the word Holocaust for the nuclear war and the warp grenades diverting their blast to the other timeline.
Why not?
To me, Holocaust has a bit of a genocide targeting tone to it.
There was comments about how some of these happen in heavily populated places and some completely vacant, which is part of what was, you know, boggling the mind of the other timeline. It's like,
yeah,
they seem random. What's the pattern? There is no pattern.
Yeah.
A Holocaust, I mean, given what they were describing of these massive nuclear explosions going off, seems fair to me.
Okay. And I guess I was just blurring it too much with genocide.
I would argue there was this is beyond mass murder at this point of...
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't even limited to Earth.
Yeah, no, that confused me a little too, because some of their space colonies or whatever.
Yeah.
Of which they have more of than the main timeline.
I don't know what word would have felt just right, but...
Yeah. I liked how the other side had a sense of the familiar, but was just a little different.
Yes.
Gray versus black jumpsuits, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Goatees. Yeah, no evil goatees. Just the eye patch. It's something that I think would give the costuming department of a movie or whatever a little something to work with, particularly if they know what's coming.
Yeah.
And certainly... This would be the thing where if you had an actor for Lucas Priest, he's got a little bit more to work with because he's on kind of both sides of the stuff.
Yeah.
Likewise, if you'd gotten a really good guest actor for Court, even though he's just there at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting how a lot of the prologues are now centering on the rapidly deceased character who often doesn't make it out of the prologue, because this one had Court dying twice at the beginning of it. The Nautilus Sanction had the sailor who'd found the sea monster dying.
Very true.
The Zenda Vendetta
had Rudolph Rosdale.
And I'm trying
the real Rudolph Rosdale got killed. That's right.
The real one got killed. Pimpernel Plot had the guy who was trying to accidentally got the real Scarlet Pimpernel killed.
Mm-hmm.
And
the Three Musketeers book, I can't think of
Ivanhoe Gambit.
Started
with Lucas. That one had Lucas at the top and the prologue and the epilogue. And the Timekeeper Conspiracy was what
Timekeeper Conspiracy is the one I'm thinking of. It had the guy who tried to leave them a message in blood.
Right. The time agent who died.
Yes.
Yeah. So other than the first book, if you star in the prologue, you're kind of doomed.
If you star in the prologue, don't have red wardrobe.
Going with the red shirt theory, I see.
Yes.
Well, and again, this is the kind of book or series of books that you could argue is formulaic, but I think that's unfair and a little inaccurate.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that there are only so many ways to sort of start one of these stories, and the odds of you just being in the past, just stumbling across an adjustment that needs to happen is kind of low. But it's like you look at a Star Trek story, and most of them are going to be, here's, either they hit the subspace anomaly, they stumble across it, or here's the mission they've been given.
A vacation in the past, where you stumble on an adjustment, would be funny.
Well, and they set that up at the end of the first book, when Lucas and Finn apparently had a six-month vacation option.
That's true.
The funny thing is, This is sort of a mission-based thing.
Yes.
Classic TV show with a mission-based venue is Mission Impossible. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, yada yada.
Mm-hmm.
There was, I think, an episode in which Phelps is going fishing and stuff and winds up having something he needs to go do and calling his team in. So even then they could go off formula.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed this. I thought Lucas's death was meaningful, was good. Seeing his counterpart and his death was good. I love the character. Curious to see, because I really don't remember Steiger that well, if at all. So my recollection on most of the other books is broad picture plot in terms of this is the sort of threat they face.
Yeah.
And with the other timeline in play, things do change up a bit. And not in a bad way, but I could see where some people could consider this being enough of a difference afterwards that this could be a jump the shark moment. I don't think it is.
Mm.
But it comes down to there are certain shows that at a certain point, what they are versus what they were is just enough different that either you can make the go with the flow or you can't. I was going to say make the adjustment or not. But that's a loaded term here.
Yes, it is.
And again, one of the things I'm loving here is how the characters are openly debating what they call Zen physics of time travel.
Yeah.
Versus just this is the way it is. Because even in all of the time travel shows we're watching right now, 12 Monkeys, Timeless, and there have been a few others. The nature of time travel, you really don't have many times. Oh, Flash is a good example too. Legends of Tomorrow is another. You don't really have too many times where people are basically sitting at the equivalent of a whiteboard trying to explain, like Doc Brown had to do for Marty, this is how the timeline splits, here's what's going on, and doing anything more than a rudimentary explanation of it. Whereas here, we're trying to understand parallel timelines, the intersection, confluence points, and splits, and how if you do that on one side, you're going to wind up now with two timelines over there that need to split, and it's going to keep progressing over time and just unravel everything and destroy everything.
Yeah.
It's something just in far as just, again, some grist for the mill, something to chew on intellectually versus not. And I liked how the warp grenades were, you know, a book or two back and, oops, not quite what we thought.
Yeah.
So the sense of ramifications and consequences,
yeah,
I appreciate with this the series of novels.
Well, and grasping the concept of unintended consequences.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good way of summing up the warp grenade situation.
Yeah.
Hey, anyone who thinks, yeah, it'll just get shunt off to a nice convenient place and not harm anybody, double check the math.
Yes.
Again, I think Brent Spiner for Dr. Darkness, he's got just enough of a flippant kind of delivery he can do.
Yes.
And arrogant. The other one I was thinking casting-wise for this, and I don't know that it's right, but he's the only one I could think of so far for Finn Delaney.
Mm-hmm.
Jason O'Mara.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From Terra Nova, from fourth season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Big enough guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think he could play the redheaded Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
Still not sure who I'd cast for the others, but it's one that the more I reread of it, the funner I think it would be to have translated into a comic book, a movie, a TV show, something, where there's the room to dive into it, give it the space it needs without padding it, but, you know, something to where, again, you could add a little bit more foreshadowing and kind of reverse consistency. Not retcon the earlier books, but again, show Lucas with a history book once in a while. Set little things up that don't impact the story, but it's, oh, okay, I'm not surprised now.
Yeah.
But again, like you said, the scene with alternate Lucas's death at the hands of Finn in front of Andre, there's just so much there that some actors could really get a lot of mileage out of.
Yeah.
Again, I'd like to see it done. I think there's a bigger audience out there for these books than has discovered them.
Yeah, I agree.
So, ton of fun. The next one is The Argonaut Affair.
Ancient Greece?
That's what I'm thinking, but I honestly don't recall.
Hmm, interesting.
Again, this is where things start taking a little bit of a different turn, because now we've got two timelines this could take place in.
Yeah, and going back to your comment of we don't really know when or how, because they do have the different physics, and there doesn't seem to have been a time split so much as there simply are now two timelines.
Well, and again, I should have highlighted that passage. The phrasing was that they had, on the other side, compared the histories, and it wasn't identical, and then at this point different. It's just there's always been little differences.
Yeah.
Not significant. They're close enough timelines that a point of convergence could happen, but that the laws of physics are different.
Yeah.
And that's all it says.
Yeah.
It doesn't say how they're different, how different they are, or anything of the sort.
Yeah.
And so we've got all of that in play. We still have Dracoff in play. And I'm trying to think if there are any other loose ends.
We still have Darkness doing his thing.
Yeah, he's probably going to invent some more stuff and cause some problems.
He showed up for the toast to Lucas.
Yeah, which I thought was a nice moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, the more I think about it, again, TV show, movies, probably TV show, I think it needs more than 2 hours, I think, per book.
Yeah.
Not a lot more. And I wouldn't want it to be stretched beyond, but I'd like to have, you know, if it takes 4 or 6 hours, whatever, give it the time it needs.
Yeah.
And be fun.
I agree.
So anything else on this? Move on to the next book?
I think move on.
Cool.
The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.